about to spend some time with a woman who is recognized as a global visionary committed to alleviating poverty, ending world hunger, and supporting social justice and environmental sustainability. There, do you hear the crack in my voice, people? It doesn't happen very often, but when it comes to the rainforest, you can count on me. She has been working to change the world for over 40 years. From working with Mother Teresa in Calcutta to the refugee camps in Ethiopia and the threatened rainforests of the Amazon, as well as guiding the philanthropy of some of the world's wealthiest families, our guest's on-the-ground work has brought her a deep understanding of people's relationship with money and with nature. Get ready to spend some wonderful, inspiring, thought-provoking time with Lynn Twist. She answered the call from the heart of the Amazon. Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, I thank you for being a part of it, because you are what makes me want to do this every single day. As many of you do know, my journey as Mrs. Green started over 10 years ago after I returned from a trip to the Amazon rainforest. It was obviously transformative, life-changing, and scary as heck. But my visit there touched me so deeply that I knew all of the tools I needed to move forward with starting a national media company would just show up magically. And indeed, over time, they have. Numerous people have helped me define and expand my journey along the way, and Lynn Twist is one of those people. You can't have a 10-minute conversation with anyone working in the Amazon without her name or that of the Pachamama Alliance coming up. And you will learn in the next hour of the reasons for that. There are many. Please join me in welcoming Lynn Twist, thought leader, author, public speaker, and co-founder of the Pachamama Alliance. So Lynn, can you tell them a little excited to have you here?
Yes, my heavens. Thank you very much. It's, holy moly.
I know. People say a lot of nice things about you. And when I saw you, I thought it hasn't even gone to her head. You just show up as you. And I love that. So let's start with this. Even though you might just get a little tired of telling the story of your journey, I doubt it, and how the Pachamama Alliance came to be, I'll never get tired of hearing it or reading about it or sharing your story with others. So can you please just tell us, take us back there, what you were doing at the time, and how did the Amazon rainforest and its people literally capture your heart and your head and probably every cell in your body that inspired you to start this mission to preserve the rainforest and its people? It's all about you now, baby.
Oh, thank you for asking. Well, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to make it manageably short. I was very, very devoted to ending world hunger and had a senior position in something called the Hunger Project, responsible for fundraising operations worldwide, which included 57 countries. So I was a very, very busy person, and I had three children, still do. And my husband was, Bill, was working in business and had two companies well underway. And, you know, we thought everything was just hunky-dory. And then in 1994, I ended up going with my friend John Perkins, who is really a famous author, to Guatemala to do a favor for our friend Bob. And in Guatemala, John Perkins, who was on the board of that organization we were visiting, John had had lots of years of experience in the Ecuadorian Amazon in the Peace Corps many, many years before, and he had become devoted to shamanism and indigenous people in the Amazon. And so when we were in Guatemala, he organized for a small group of us to go see a Mayan shaman named Roberto Pose, a very interesting man. And we had a ceremony with Roberto Pose, the shaman, the Mayan shaman, on a hill, the top of a hill, in the middle of the night, around midnight, near Totonicapan in Guatemala. And the shaman built a fire, and he asked us in Mayan, and then John translated from Mayan into Spanish and then Spanish into English, to lay around the fire, 12 of us, with our feet towards the fire, which we did do. And then the shaman began to chant and to drum. And his voice was so incredible, his chanting and his drumming. And the night sky and the night air and the crackling fire and the stars and this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience I was having. And he told us to close our eyes and journey. And I didn't know really what that meant, but I figured I would close my eyes and take a nice nap or just listen to the beautiful sounds of his voice and the drum. And it became more and more hypnotic for me, the sound of his voice and the sound of that drum. And eventually I began to go into some sort of an altered state. And my right arm began to quiver, and then it began to shake, and then I just had to extend it as I felt it turn into a gigantic wing. And then my left arm started to quiver and shake, and then I felt it have to extend into a huge second wing. And then I felt a beak grow on my face, and I had to fly. I could not lie there for one more second. I had to extend my arms, which were now wings, and I had to fly. I lifted my body up above the campfire. I saw myself and the other 11 people around the campfire with the shaman singing and chanting, and I could hear the shaman's voice and the drum very clearly, in fact, just as clearly as when I was lying there. And I began to fly in slow motion up into the night sky. It was a brilliant starry night, no moon. And as I flew into the sky in slow motion, these giant wings, I had become this amazing bird. And I looked down, and eventually, after a while, it began to turn into dawn. And I could see that I was flying over a vast, unending forest of green that went forever and ever and ever. And I looked down through the huge trees, and I could see through the canopy all the way to the forest floor. I had very acute vision. But then I would lift up my gaze, and I would see way ahead more and more and more, more forest. It just went forever. And at a certain point, while I was flying over this beautiful sight, these disembodied faces of men with orange geometric face paint and yellow, red, and black feather crowns began to float up toward the bird, calling to the bird, that was me, in a strange tongue. And then they would disappear back into the forest, and then they would float up again. These faces, disembodied, with orange geometric face paint and yellow, red, and black feather crowns, they were beautiful faces. But I didn't understand what they were saying to me, and they were calling to the bird. And then they would disappear again. And so this went on and on and on, and it was hypnotic. It was something beautiful about it. It was exquisite. It was intimate. And it was, as I say, mesmerizing. And then at a certain point, I heard a very loud drum beat, bang, 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 bang. And it startled me. And that drum beat was clearly the shaman. And I sat up. I opened my eyes. The fire was all the way down to embers, so this had been quite a long time. I had no wings, I had no beak, I was a human being. And I looked around the circle, and everyone was discombobulated, you know, kind of waking from a strange dream or from a amazing experience. Everybody looked kind of out of it like I did. And then the shaman, through my friend John Perkins, asked people to share about their journey, and each person shared that they had become an animal. Every single person had that experience except for one who had a dream, fell asleep and dreamt about her grandchildren. But everyone else had become some sort of an animal, a snake, a squirrel, a butterfly, a bear. And when it was my turn, I shared the story of becoming a bird, just what I've shared with you. And then it went around the circle until it got to my friend John. And he shared a story very, very much like mine. So then the shaman completed the ritual, and then he asked John and I to stay, and the other people left. And he told us that we were being communicated to by a people somewhere on the planet, and this was not a normal journey. It was a communication. It was a call. It was a calling, and we needed to respond. We needed to go to them. Well, this was completely, you know, far-fetched for me. I didn't really understand that. I didn't know how to relate to it. But my friend John Perkins, he knew exactly what it was. In fact, he knew who the people were who were trying to reach out and where they were. He had recently, just before that, been in the Ecuadorian Amazon, right near the equator, with the Shuar people. And the Shuar people had opened the door for him to meet with the Achuar people. people who had had almost no contact with the outside world. And they had shared with John and the Schwab brothers that they were going to start seeking contact, that they had seen in their dreams and visions that danger was coming to their pristine, roadless territory in the year 2000. And so they decided to reach out to the modern world to draw people to them that they could trust that would, in 1994, this was 1994, begin to educate them about the modern world, become their modern world partners, and help them understand how to resist the danger when it came in the year 2000. And this was that. This is what John told me. And I said, John, I can't get involved in the Amazon. I don't speak Spanish. I've never been to South America. I'm working in Africa and Asia on ending world hunger, and I have huge responsibilities. You go to the Amazon. I have to do my work in Africa. So I went on from there to Ghana, which is a country in West Africa where there was a board meeting for the Hunger Project, my work at that time. And I was sitting in a room in the first floor of the Novotel in Accra, Ghana, which is the capital city. And I was in a meeting, a board meeting, of Ghanaian people, five men and three women sitting around a board table. I was the only non-Ghanaian or white person there. And Ghanaian people are very beautiful people. They have very dark skin, almost blue-black. And we're sitting there having a conversation, and suddenly the men, the five men at the table, start having orange geometric face paint just appear on their blue-black faces. And I was just,
oh my gosh,
because no one said anything about it, not one word. And I thought, oh my God, I'm hallucinating. So I quietly left and went to the ladies' room and pulled myself together. The conversation continued. I came back and joined in, and everything was fine and normal, and then it happened again. And when it happened the second time, I burst into tears, and people said to me, what's the matter? And they so obviously did not see the orange geometric face paint on these men's faces. Even the men themselves were saying to me, what's the matter? And I said, well, I think I'm sick. I'm feeling unwell. I need to go back to the United States. I can't stay for our meetings. I just need to go. So I went up. I was in the hotel where I was staying. I went up and packed my bag, went straight to the Accra airport, took the first plane to Europe, went to Frankfurt, then Frankfurt to New York, then New York to San Francisco, where I live. And the whole way, waking or sleeping, eyes open or shut, the faces came towards me, the orange geometric face paint on their faces and the yellow, red, and black feather crowns. They would not stop. So when I got home, the only person I could really tell was John Perkins, and he was in the Amazon. He had gone back. I told my husband, Bill, but I didn't tell him the way I'm telling you because I really didn't believe it. I thought I was going crazy. But eventually John came back saying, they're waiting for us, Lynn. They want us to bring 12 people from the modern world to them for their first real encounter with the outside world. They want people with open hearts, people who have global voice, 12 people who know that the rainforest is critical to the future of life, people who know that the indigenous wisdom is critical for the survival of life on Earth, and people who will respect the ways of the shaman. And so John Perkins and I put a group of 12 together, including ourselves. The first person I invited was Bill Twist, my husband. And the 12 of us went down to Quito, traveled down, as you have, the Valley of the Volcanoes, over the eastern side of the Andes, down through the cloud forest, down through the Pastaza River Canyon, to the edge of the vast, vast, vast Amazon rainforest that stretches all the way across the continent and is larger than the United States. And we flew in small planes into Achuar territory and were left on a dirt landing area right near a river till all 12 of us were there, and then they came out of the forest with their orange geometric face paint, their yellow, black, and red feather crowns, and spears, and they were the Achuar leaders, and they took us in their canoes to a place where we camped, and we began an encounter over which I never got, which began the Pachamama Alliance.
I think we should press pause, and I need to go out and take a break, because I wonder, as I was sitting here, not wanting you to stop, if this would be the opportunity for people that I try to tell the story of what happened to me, which is not anything on the scale of what happened to you, that the Amazon rainforest, it gets into your DNA. And that sounds so melodramatic and so crazy, but it's so real. It does get into you. And from the time I went till the time I just went back, I crave going there. I want to go back more and more. And it's sacred. What you just described is sacred. And we can't, I don't know how anybody would ever describe John Perkins. I was so blessed to spend time with him at the Global Alliance gathering in Petaluma. And I just watched him. I didn't spend a lot of time talking with him because there was always a line, but I watched a lot. I was quietly observing. And he is, I don't know, I did say to him, John, thank you so much for Confessions of a Economic Hitman, which confirmed all my conspiracy theories that I have ever had. But he's a tremendous human being. So it's almost as though, I try to describe it as the Amazon, is it's inside of you. And that's what you described. It got you. And there yeah. you go. And there you go.
I think it lives in everyone because it's the source, that place where you went, where I've been, where we take people now, is the source of the Amazon system, which is the source of the global climate system. And in many ways, it's going to the heart of the heart of the heart of the world rather than the middle of nowhere. It's going to the heart of everywhere. And I think it lives in every heart and soul, and you don't know it until you go there. And you scared at first, like you said, but eventually you realize you're somehow in a place that's very deeply your home.
And that really, really matters. So I have to ask the obvious, what happened for Bill? Did he like go down and say, Lynn, I get it, let's do it?
Exactly. That's a good description. He wasn't going to come at first. It kind of sounded a little bit too outlandish to him. But then when we went down and we actually connected with the indigenous leaders, I would say that in many ways they called for me because they were looking for him. Bill is the CEO of Pachamama Alliance, and his connection with the indigenous leaders, particularly the men, they immediately recognized something in him. His warrior spirit, perhaps, his deep integrity, I don't know, his courage. They connected with him more than any of us right away, and he connected with them. And although he didn't expect that, he was kind of going along because this was kind of John's thing and Lynn's thing, but it ended up being very much his thing. And now he's left his business world behind, and he's the CEO of Pachamama Alliance. And, you know, it really touched him very deeply. And his origin story is quite different than mine because his origin story is more organized around the Eco Lodge where we ended up staying for all these years, which was being built when we first got there.
Is that Kapawi?
Kapawi Lodge, yeah.
Okay.
And he's there actually right now, and Kapawi is being rebuilt. So he has a deep and powerful origin story of his own about that lodge and why it's there and how it came to be there and how important it is to the Achuar people and to the world.
So many questions come to mind because I told you when we chatted a little bit off air about interviewing Tom Lovejoy, who is an advisor to the United Nations on the environment, and he's a professor at George Mason University. But his passion and his love is a camp that he started for students in the Brazilian rainforest. So he does that, and he does science, and he brings people down there over the summer, and I'm not in any way minimizing it, but you and Bill and John, you went in the direction of starting a global alliance in actual partnership with the indigenous people, very different, in partnership with the people of the Amazon, the Achuar, to engage thousands of other people working to support the mission and vision of the Pachamama Alliance. What, in the beginning stages, what were you being guided to do that went far beyond the scope of raising awareness or doing scientific research? They're both important, but your work was to engage thousands in the work of preserving the rainforest. Were the Achuar guiding you? Was it coming from within? I mean, this is a long roadmap. You had to start somewhere.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we often share, which you know yourself is the way it is there, the indigenous people, when we had our first encounter with them, the Achuar, they said in their own way, if you're coming to help us, even though we invited you here and called you here, don't waste your time. But if you're coming because you know your liberation is bound up with ours, then let's work together. And that ethic, that foundation is the foundation of the way we work at Pachamama Alliance. They also said to us, we need your support to understand the modern world. We need to understand what country we're in. We need to understand the Ecuadorian government, why they want to come into our territory. And we need your help, yes. But the real pressure on these forests isn't really from the government or from oil or mining companies, even though that's how it shows up. It's from the dream of the modern world. And you, if you really want to preserve these forests, help us preserve our culture, you need to go home and change the dream of the modern world. Now, that is a tall order.
No
and
kidding.
We didn't even quite, you know, we pretended like we didn't really understand what it meant. But we did know, because they somehow in their great wisdom see that we in the modern world are living in a trance. They called it a dream, which is a nicer word for it, but in a trance that has us fouling the very life support system on which we all depend, destroying that which would give future generations access to a healthy and fulfilling life. You know, how could we possibly be doing that unless we're in some sort of a trance or numb to the consequences of our actions? And they're not caught in the trance, so they can see how deeply we're entranced, how deeply we're caught in it. So they don't make us wrong for it, thank God. They have compassion for how caught we are. So they told us to go home and change the dream of the modern world, which is a tall order, as I say. So we began first with supporting them with land titling and mapping and the kind of tools that they needed to protect their land and territory and understand their territory and what rights they had, their international rights, their indigenous rights, their national rights, their legal rights. And so we did a lot of work right in the beginning with that, because that was there in front of our noses and they needed that. And they knew that danger was coming, and they saw that it would come in 1999 or the year 2000. So in the first years, that's what we focused on. But all the while, this request to change the dream of the modern world was haunting us. Really, it was in our soul. It was in the back of our mind. We couldn't pretend like we didn't hear that. But it took us maybe 10 years before we really, really tackled it, or maybe 8. And then we were working on it all the time in a way, but in order to change the dream of the modern world, we needed to wake up from it ourselves. We needed to see how caught we were personally in the dream of the modern world and how even good people are caught in that trance. And then we began to develop what's called the Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream Symposium, which is a transformational educational program that wakes people up from the trance, has them see how we got here and what's possible now, freeing ourselves from that trance to bring forth an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, socially just human presence on this planet. So that was the process, and now the symposium and its children, you could say, the different versions of it, have spread to 82 countries. It's followed by the Game Changer Intensive, which is the course that looks at structures and systems that we're caught in, and the Drawdown course, which is the revelation that we can reverse global warming. And so now, consistent with their request, we are an organization not only supporting the work to preserve the sacred headwaters of the Amazon rainforest with the indigenous people by empowering them, but also at their request and out of their mandate, we are doing educational programs around the world, transformational educational programs around the world that awaken people from the trance and have them see that they can make a difference and live in a completely different way, a much more fulfilling life. So that's the process that we went through, and it was very exciting and very challenging and very beautiful.
And it's ever-evolving. I mean, it's ever, ever-evolving. There's still so much more. So just take us back a little bit because of how you described your journey and how it got started, you know, foundational to this origin story are the Achuar people, the visionary warriors of the Amazon. Try to do in a way that only Lynn Twist can really do, and I'm really sincere when I say that, try to paint a picture for who the Achuar people are. And as I said to you, on my visit, I'm a big talker, and you know that, but I was a big listener. I was an observer. I watched. I went quiet. I hope the people on the trip thought that was what I was doing, but I was doing that. and, you know, when we were in social, but starting with, I noticed they are a quiet people because they live in the jungle and they live off the land from the jungle. So they speak softly. They walk gently on the earth. You know, they live very simply. No part of me ever thought, oh my gosh, they're so poor. Ever. They're sophisticated. So tell us about the Achuar people. Get our audiences connected to who these people are. They're incredible.
Well, the Achuar are the people that really contacted us in the beginning, as I said, and we were so fortunate to begin our relationship with them, just to broaden the listening of who Pachamama is. We now work with all the indigenous tribes in the Amazon, in the particular region where we work in southern Ecuador and northern Peru, the Sacred Headwaters area. There's 17 tribes in that area, and the Achuar were the central part of our understanding. And all indigenous people, particularly the Achuar, they don't live in the forest, they are of the forest.
Yes.
The plants and animals are their kin, like really their kin, their relations, really their relations. When they walk through the forest or even move quickly through the forest, they do it without making almost any sound. Not with their feet, not with their mouth, not with the way they rustle the trees. And they move through the forest aware that they are surrounded by millions of souls. They actually see and feel that every living thing has a soul. So they live and imagine or be in the presence of, let's say, millions of souls as they walk through the dense, beautiful, abundant, glorious rainforest. They don't own anything, the Achuar people. They don't understand or really agree with ownership or possessions. Everything belongs to everyone. The ethic of the way they live is if the community is healthy, then everybody in the community is fine. So the focus is on the health and well-being of the entire community, the village or the tribe. And if someone falls sick in the tribe, everyone takes care of them. So it's everyone takes care of everybody else, and everyone owes everybody their allegiance. So, for example, if you were an Achuar man or woman, and I helped you build your house out of the forest, helped you weave your roof and put up your walls and create your house. If I helped you build your house, you would for sure help me with the feast of my daughter's wedding. That would be just obvious. And they don't use any money. So if I were to pay you if you were to pay me for helping you build your house, then that would end our relationship in some way or cut it short. But if I help you with your house, you help me with my daughter's wedding, I hunt for you when you're out of the territory, you hunt and fish for me if I fell ill and take care of my family. Everybody owes everybody everything all the time. So there's a tight-knit relatedness where the health and well-being and security is in the relationships people have with one another. That's the wealth rather than money. They now use money to do things on the outside, but they don't use money among each other. And their reverence for life, their reverence for every single creature, even the ones that they hunt, is really deep and great. And they witness rather than judge. So you never feel judged by the Achuar. You feel witnessed. Witnessing is very different than judging. All of us, we're so expert at making each other wrong and making ourselves wrong or right.
Right.
But that's just not part of the way they are. They are they witness, so they notice everything. They're highly conscious. So those are some of the things that I can say about them. And all in all, I would say there's such a deep wisdom and sophistication in the way they live. You know, when I first went there, I thought I was meeting with people who are primitive. Well, in some ways, yes, sanitation is not a big thing for them. They don't have this, that, and the other thing that we consider so essential. But they're very, very sophisticated in their ways, ways in which we're somewhat arrested and undeveloped. So they're highly developed in some ways where we're less developed, and we're highly developed in some ways where they're less developed. But really, it's a function of where they live and what they face each day. They are very equipped to handle it, and their love for the forest is unconditional and unlimited. They are of it and for it.
And so beautifully put. And when you're there, like I would wake up in the morning and I was close to the fire. They would start the fire in the morning and you could hardly hear them. And I say that because they're not big and loud and bold and bodacious. They're gentle. That's the word, that gentle and fierce and strong. It was something that I observed over and over and over. And what really surprised me, and I thought a lot about why it took me so long to get this interview. And part of it is, I had to go there and see through the eyes of the Pachamama Alliance and understand, because my first journey was like a whirlwind. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I'm coming back. This has touched me. I went to the Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream Symposium, and stand up in front of, you know, a room of 100 people, most of whom knew me. And I said, yeah, I'm going to start a national radio show. They thought I had come undone. But when you, it's like, she's going to what? She has no background in any of this. And it's like, it just doesn't matter. And it happened. But what surprised me is that many of them, they go out into the world and they go to the city and they get educated and they are, like you said, they're sophisticated and knowledgeable and they come back. And believe me, I can see that. I mean, they're not checking their email every 5 minutes and they're not on their phones. They are being in a very peaceful way. And the other thing that I'd like you to comment on, we had Katie Curran with us, who's doing a film, another film she did, you know, Greening the Revolution. But she was working on a film about sexual violence in cultures around the world. And not just from the point of painting the perpetrator as the bad guy, but as a systemic understanding of cultures. And they don't have sexual violence in the Achuar tribe. And she was convinced of that. She said, I'm such a skeptic and I just have to interview one more person. And I was bunkmates with her and she said, Gina, I'm sure of it. So there's no sexual violence that we got any sense of. There's no substance abuse, no alcohol abuse. Nobody's, you know, hooked on opioids. They have the purest of lives in that sense. And then I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your observations in terms of the role of women as it was when you started, because the one girl that I was her grip. I said, you better mention me in the movie. But I was holding things for her. And she was, the men and the women were very protective of her being interviewed. And I believe that she was one of the first people to go through the Jungle Mamas program, which we will talk about. But as you have been with them side by side, have you seen the role of women change from what it was in 1994 to what it is now?
Oh, yes, very much so. Because I worked for the Hunger Project for 20 years, and one of our central insights and strategies was empowering women and girls, which is probably the most effective strategy for ending world hunger, I had been focused so much on empowering women and girls and giving them voice and access to credit and leadership opportunities and education, that when I got to the Amazon and saw the culture there, which is the Achuar culture is a warrior culture, and the men are in the foreground and the women are in the background, really preparing men for war because they were warrior culture and warring with the other tribes for literally hundreds of years. And they have been pacified only for maybe 40 years. So the traditions around war and the cultural energy around men being more important than women in many ways because of war, and women's job to give birth to sons and prepare those sons and the fathers and the brothers and the husbands for war, was the kind of tenor of the culture that I saw. And the women were in the background making chicha, their national, their very important carbohydrate drink. And we weren't really allowed to speak with the women. And some men had 4, 5, 6 wives. And it just looked like, oh, my God, I don't want to come back next lifetime as an Achuar woman.
They have terrible here. They still have a lot of hard work to do.
And they were very demure and shy, and none of them spoke Spanish. So I was thinking, gosh, they're so oppressed, so suppressed. And then I learned, or we learned, that the way that they give birth, and many of them have many children, is to go out into the jungle all by themselves, because everything sacred happens in the forest, not in the home. So sex is in the forest, and giving birth is in the forest. And the women were for forever going out by themselves with a machete in labor.
Oh my gosh.
In the forest, giving birth. And if there was a footling or a breach or a hemorrhage, they would die, or the baby would die, or they had twins, or, you know, it was just impossible for them to give birth to their own baby while they were in labor. Yet they've been doing that for hundreds of years at tremendous cost to the women, just horrendous trauma. And many, many women would die, leaving, you know, dozens of children with no mom. So the women began to tell us that they needed help with childbirth. That's how the relationship with the women began. And they told a particular person named Margaret Love, who was a midwife. And when she introduced herself in a group like the one you were in when you visited an Achuar home, I'm sure you introduced yourselves and said what your profession was. She introduced herself to the men in a home and said that she was a midwife, which meant that and a nurse, and that she was particularly expertise in giving birth to babies. And the women who were way behind the men who were in the forefront physically in this geographic home heard the translation and asked to meet with her after a few of the interchanges had taken place. And so Margaret, God bless her soul, had an interpreter, and the women told her they needed help with childbirth. And that conversation was the beginning of Margaret making a commitment to begin the work of Jungle Mamas. And she did it in partnership with a Shuar woman named Narcisa Macienta, who also saw how much suffering was going on, and walked from village to village. There's no roads in the place where we're talking about. Walked, you know, 2 and 3 days from one village to the next village, to the next community, you know, years of work to convince the women and the men that it was time to really change the ways the culture was treating childbirth and learn from some of the people who've been working in other parts of the world about how it could be done safely. And that was the beginning of a program that's now called Ikiyama Nukuri, formerly called Jungle Mamas. Ikiyama Nukuri means women who are the keepers of the forest. And that program began our relationship with the women. We didn't really have a relationship with the women until then. And now the women who've been through the training program to learn how to help other women give birth in a safe way with birthing kits and some sanitation and, you know, an attendant, those women speak much louder. Their tiny little voices have gotten much louder. You can actually talk to them. Their posture has changed. They realize that they can, that their dreams matter, that their voice matters. So it's been completely transformational, and it's been such a privilege to witness it. It's historic. After hundreds of years, women having literally no voice, now having a voice, is mind-boggling. I mean, it's just awesome.
And it's just something that you feel when you're there. One of the things that I believe is essential to your mission is actually leading these trips to the Amazon. And if I'm not living proof, I don't know what is. And I'm not kidding. It's like, who comes back after 35 years in social services and starts, you know, now I call myself an environmental educator, which I believe I am. I'm spreading the word. But that's how it transformed me. And I know I'm not the only one. why do you believe, other than the Mrs. Green example, which there are many, that it's really important to get people there to see what you see, to feel what I felt, to be really present and experience the Achuar people and the rainforest? Why is it so critical to fulfilling your mission, which I believe it is? I wish we could have hordes of people going down there on planes weekly.
Well, first of all, the word Pachamama means Mother Earth, or to the Quechua people whose word it is in their language, the earth, the sky, the universe, and all time. And this is an alliance between the indigenous peoples of the sacred headwaters of the Amazon rainforest and conscious, committed people in the modern world like you and all the people that are listening for the sustainability of life. And we have lost touch, we being in the modern world, with our relationship with the natural world. We, you know, the children really think milk comes from the grocery store. They don't realize it comes from a cow. And you know, people think
right.
that, you know, that you get to, in the habit of thinking that that pomegranates and oranges and asparagus really come from the store instead of the ground. And we've really lost touch, not just with the food supply, but with all kinds of the services, you could say, that nature provides that give us life. And when you go to the deep into the rainforest, it's not only the rainforest itself, but where we were called and where we work is the sacred headwaters of the entire Amazon system. Where the Amazon comes from is the sacred headwaters region at the foot of the Andes, two double mountain ranges that have been primarily volcanic, and some are still active volcanoes. So the water coming from those mountains is super dynamic, and it feeds into the thousands of rivers that make up the Amazon. And so where we take people is right there to the source of the Amazon rainforest, which is the source of our climate system. And it's the hydrological source of the planet and the lungs of the planet. It's both the lungs and the heart of the planet. And somehow when you go there, if no one told you that, you still know it in your heart and in your lungs. And so I think that's part of the power of it. And also, the indigenous people there have had contact now for, you know, many, many years, but they have not changed at all. They have what they need to have to survive and to protect that territory, not just for themselves, but for the future of life with our partnership. And you realize when you're there that this is a huge privilege to be engaged in this area of this planet, the most biodiverse ecosystem on this planet is the place I'm talking about. Millions of species migrated there during the Ice Age, during the Pleistocene era. It served as a Noah's Ark, and those species were saved because of that area. And then that area, sacred headwaters of the Amazon, repopulated life after the Pleistocene era, and it can do it again if other ecosystems fail. And somehow, even if no one tells you that, you feel it when you're there. And it's absolutely vital that we protect this particular ecosystem. We need to protect all ecosystems, but this one is absolutely untouchable, has to be untouchable. And that's where we were called. That's where you've been. That's where we invite people to go. And we don't invite everyone in the entire world, although that would be nice.
Right.
We invite people who understand how precious it is to have that encounter with those indigenous people, and what a responsibility you carry, just as you carry it so beautifully, once you return to the modern world, to share the information, the wisdom, and the important time that we're living in, and how people can turn the tide and make a difference.
So there's the whole pieces of, you know, the ecotourism to help the Achuar with their not just surviving but thriving, which is, people can't even I could never explain what it was like to go there. I can't. And I wasn't scared, and I'm a scaredy cat. I am. I wasn't scared. I saw one spider, and it was in my friend's suitcase because she didn't lock it. It was just, I mean, we went on night walks and we saw a lot of bugs, but it's the sacredness, like I said, the gentleness, all of that. So explain to us on the other track. You talked about several times the permanent protection of the sacred headwaters. That's one of the major accomplishments from where I sit of the Pachamama Mom Alliance. What did that take? That just happened, I think, as recently as last year. What does that mean? And is it really permanent when government heads change and big oil comes in with their big checkbooks? Is it really permanent protection?
Well, it isn't now. It's under constant threat still from oil and mining and all kinds of incursions. The indigenous people have repelled and kept out 12 oil companies in the years we've been there, the 23 years we've been there, and mining companies as well. And it's almost impossible that that happened, because these companies have billions of dollars and millions of employees. The indigenous people have practically no money, and there's thousands of them, handfuls of them. And they've kept these huge, huge companies out, which the government of Ecuador and Peru was trying to get in there. So it's almost incomprehensible that they have maintained these forests with no roads. There's no roads. So something else is going on. There's a spiritual power in this place. And we didn't really know that until a couple years ago, when ecological economists have really said this is the sacred headwaters, this is the source of the ecological system. And the indigenous people, although they could never have said that, they kind of knew that all along. And so we now realize, since oil prices have begun to teeter and, in fact, dramatically drop and now going up and down, but never as high as they were, there's less pressure on this particular place because there's no roads. The infrastructure to build it would be so expensive that the oil concessions are starting to wane in their aggressiveness in getting in there because they can't make a big enough profit. So there's a space now, a magic space, a miraculous space, where the indigenous peoples, all the different tribes, have come together and are now initiating a project, an initiative is probably a better word, to put this place, southern Ecuador, northern Peru, about 60 to 100 million acres of pristine primary rainforest, the most important ecosystem on Earth, in permanent protected status. Now, there's no such thing as permanent protected status, as
right.
You kind of pointed out.
Right.
But there was no such thing as giving rights to nature, which now Ecuador has done in their constitution, and nature can be defended in court in a court of law in Ecuador and now in 25 countries since Ecuador passed that constitution. So there's new insights, there's new distinctions being born now to protect the natural world. And we are declaring, we, Pachamama Alliance, in partnership with Amazon Watch, that works closely with us there and the indigenous leaders, that we will create permanent protected status for this place with these two nations. And what it would take is billions and billions and billions of dollars being compensating Ecuador and Peru to forego developing the rainforest with oil and mining, because they depend on that revenue for their economies. And so the world community will need to step up and provide compensation for these countries to put this this area for decades, and we want permanent, but we need to ensure that it was decades beyond the comings and goings of different administrations, in permanent protected status. And if you think about Yosemite as an example, it's not in permanent protected status legally, but no one's going to touch it now because it's been pristine and untouched for so long. Even our a little bit out of line current president is not going to mess with Yosemite. Other places maybe, but and so it's untouchable for decades, long enough, and we can set that kind of a precedent and begin to initiate on this planet something called permanent protected status for critical ecosystems. Pachamama Alliance and the indigenous peoples of the Amazon, with our partner Amazon Watch, are setting that goal. And it may take 20 years. I may not see it in my lifetime. You may not see it in your lifetime, Mrs. Green, because we're in the, we're a different age. However, it will happen. This is what we're going to make happen.
And you say that about not being here, and it just, like, it really aggravates me, because I want to see some of these stories end with happy ending. Not all dreams are sweet. And so this is one that So oil and mining are the two biggest threats. And I just want to take a little different tack for a minute. I want to talk about your website. And that may sound very strange, but there's a sense I get when I visit the website that it's intentional. Every word, it's been word steward. Like the word steward, whoever worked on that was a master. And it's peaceful. And that sounds like a weird way to describe a website, but it is very peaceful. And I was touched by reading some of the guided principles. And I wanted to just talk about one that you might be able to, and I think you wove it so beautifully into the conversation. And it says, one of the most effective ways to produce results is to empower other organizations through skillful alliances. And a principle of skillful alliances is that amazing things can be accomplished when people aren't worrying about who's getting credit. So do you have any examples about how you have put that into the action with some of your work? And what are some of the skillful alliances? I just wanted to go a little deeper on that one.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for pointing that out. Yes, Pachamama Alliance is not we do not have the intention to become a big organization
right.
like Nature Conservancy or right. Conservation International. We have enormous respect for all of those big, wonderful NGOs, but that's not our interest. We are catalytic. We're what we call sourceful, and we inaugurate, initiate, and source and catalyze. So, for example, I mentioned the rights of nature, giving legal rights to nature under fundamental primary law. That took place in Ecuador 10 years ago. Pachamama Alliance was instrumental, but it was really the work of the indigenous people who were at the table in the Constitutional Congress who made that happen. Since that time, the Pachamama Alliance, with our indigenous partners, initiated something called the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature, with a team of very sophisticated lawyers who considered this a big breakthrough to turn property law on its head so that river systems and forest systems, living entities, can be protected in court or defended in court. That breakthrough was so significant, and the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature, which we seeded with some seed funding, but then after catalyzing it, it went out on its own. And now it's 10 years later, and it's wonderful you're asking me this, because in Ecuador last week, the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature, which is now a worldwide organization that we had, you know, we initiated, we helped to get it started, but it's not us, conducted a global summit that where there were 270 people, leaders, lawyers, law professors, government officials from around the world, from 25 countries, who now have given legal rights to nature in their legal system. And 15 countries who are in the process of doing that, so 40 countries. We can't take credit for that. We did not do it, but we initiated it. We had something to do with it. But no one really will remember that the Pachamama Alliance got that whole thing started when country after country after country after country starts giving legal rights to rivers, to trees, to forests, to living entities. That's an example of the Pachamama Alliance empowering other organizations to succeed. And people may be able to trace it back to Pachamama Alliance, but we're not seeking to take credit for that. I'm saying that to you because you kind of know. But we were fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time and have the skill set and the insight to affirm and orchestrate that taking place in a way that it's taken off and now is a global movement.
Oh, and it's just, I mean, when I read that statement about accomplished when people aren't worrying about who's getting credit, that's the end game. I mean, it's like, let's just do this because it's the right thing, the good thing to do for ourselves and the planet. So I love that one. And then the other one that I loved is people's actions are correlated with how they see the world, the story they tell themselves about the world, transforming the way that people see and relate to the world and the possibilities they see for the future of it is a powerful way to affect social change. And you have done that. Is the how, not just by you know, getting people there who get the call. Not everybody goes. And I'll give you an example. My friend Molly Stranahan, who you know, she's one of my best friends. And she doesn't want to go there with me, but she gets it. She gets it. She goes to the symposiums. She is a financial supporter. She's a believer. And she helped ignite my passion. So as a guiding principle, how does that, that's a tough question I'm asking. How do you put that into operation? How do you operationalize that, transforming the way that people see and relate to the world and let them see the possibilities? It has to be, it's not the Kool-Aid. What are you doing to cast a spell on so many people?
Well, we have a wonderful lineage, I would say. Some of us at Pachamama Alliance, some of our founding group, from the EST training way back in the early 70s, and also the Landmark Forum, and then the Hunger Project, which kind of came out of some of that ontological work. And we have a competency in ontology. So ontology means the study of being, the way we be. And so Pachamama Alliance has a particular capacity to address the being sphere, or let's see, who we're being rather than who and what we're doing. And so we don't, many organizations tell people, here's what you should do. We do that to some extent, but mostly we talk about, here's who you want to be. And that that way of approaching shifts the way the world occurs for people. It shifts the way they see themselves. It creates an opening for people to take action they might not have realized they could take. And then that action is the action they generate rather than someone told them to take it. So, for example, you started your media company. No one told you to do that at Pachamama Alliance. No one said, now you have to go back there and spread the word about this. We may have told you, please share this with your friends.
Right.
We didn't tell you to start a media company. So people come up with things that shock them, really, that they, because they've had a shift in the way they see the world. How we do it is through the transformational educational programs and really addressing underneath how we perceive the world. Because right now, for example, one line that you'll remember from the symposium, the Awakening Dreamer Symposium, Julia Butterfly Hill, one of the great environmental leaders that's filmed in that program, she says, when we throw something away, where is away?
Right.
There's no such place. Now, that phrase, that sentence, is not something that most people had ever thought of before. They just throw things away. Where is away? There's no such place. Is a phrase that shifts the way you see yourself and your world. And the next time you put something in a waste basket or in the garbage can or toss something over your shoulder to a waste receptacle, it may show up for you, gosh, where is that going to go? And could that be recycled or could that be reused? So that phrase, that simple phrase, is a shift in perception or invites a shift in the way the world occurs to you. So that's an example of the way the Pachamama Alliance works. And that's our competency. That's one of the things we do well.
And maybe why I so loved reading the guiding principles is because I know enough now to see that they're interwoven in everything you do. It's fun. It's fabulous. It's authentic. People are real. You know, I'm just basically a cheerleader and part of the movement. We have about a minute left, which blows me away. We were clearly in a time warp, and it is not 60 minutes. But the last bit of wisdom I'd like you to share with us, not everybody is blessed and able to go to the rainforest. And I know how blessed I was. I know. And I will go back. I can guarantee you I will go back to visit the Achuar people. We have thousands of listeners. What else can they do? Visit your website, decide to give a dollar or two or five or ten a month, educate themselves about the importance of the rainforest. What's your parting shot on why this matters so much? And it's not about Lynn and Bill Twist and John Perkins. It's about our survival. What's the precious pearl of wisdom you want to leave us with, Lynn Twist?
Well, if you go to the website, pachamama.org, you'll see several courses. One is the Awakening the Dreamer course online. Next is Game Changer Intensive online. And the third is Drawdown, which is in person but will soon be online. And I recommend you do that and do all those courses. That's one thing. And we love it when you make a contribution and reallocate some of your financial resources to the Pachamama Alliance, of course. I also really recommend you get the book Drawdown by Paul Hawken.
I love it. I've had him on the show. I mean, talk about another rock star in my world. Like, I was so nervous. And he's so soft-spoken.
And that his book is a real revelation on how
it is.
We can reverse global warming, not mitigate it, not stop it, not be afraid of it, not be the victim of it, not try to slow it down, but reverse it. And there's 100 solutions in that book. And you can pick any one of them and get started if you haven't already.
Great takeaway.
Then third, I would say to share this program, the one that we're doing right now, and any other thing you come across that technically or virtually awakens people from the trance. We're in the business of awakening people and keeping them awake, so they don't go back into the trance, which is so devastating for us and for the world we live in. So to stay awake and to find programs, podcasts, books, courses that keep you awake and help you wake up other people.
Right.
So
it's like your vitamin B12 shot. Just keep pouring it in. So I cannot thank you enough. I'm sure that you feel that. I don't have to tell you that. And I just want to forward promote two shows coming up. On the 15th, our local show is Callie Siderwitz to discuss diabetes care in our community. It's at an epidemic level. And on November 27th, another one of my heroes, Seth Godin. I can't believe it. Seth said yes again. Race to the bottom or climb to the top. So Lynn Twiss, thank you. And I hope everybody listens and gets engaged and takes a step forward, because we need us all to do that. Make it a great green, intentionally lived day, week, and life. Thanks everybody for being a part of my world. And thank you, Lynn Twiss, for showing up in mine.
Thank you so much. I loved it.
I did too.